It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll find out what we can learn about American politics from the TV show Mad Men, which airs its final episode this Sunday.
First, some news about the bat population. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced yesterday that white nose syndrome has spread to 8 counties across the state.
The fungus that causes white nose syndrome has been decimating bat populations in various parts of the country.
A decline in the bat population could have adverse effects on many aspects of life in Wisconsin, including the environment, human health, and even the economy.
With us now to provide more details is DNR conservation biologist Jennifer Riddell. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, start us off, please, by sharing these new findings. Where are we starting to see this disease in the state?
Well, unfortunately, as you mentioned, at the conclusion now of our winter surveillance activities looking for the disease at 75 different locations across Wisconsin, we've found it present in 14 different cave and mine locations spread across 8 counties. So we found the disease itself in Grant, Crawford, Richland, Dane, and Door counties. And then we found the fungus that causes white nose syndrome in caves and mines in Iowa, Dodge, and Lafayette counties.
And in the survey, I understand you returned to a site in Grant County, which was the first place the disease was detected last year. What did you find revisiting that site?
Correct. So our initial site of discovery of infection in the state was a mine in Grant County that we have multiple years of data for, and we've got about 1,000 bats at that site. We noticed a 70% decline in that population in between last winter when the disease was first detected and this winter when we revisited.
And forgive me if I'm stating the obvious, but that huge decline in bat population, that site, was that, do you believe, because of white nose syndrome?
It is. And what we noticed when we went to that site is that not only were many of the bats missing altogether, but the remaining bats, the majority of them had fungus, visible fungus on them.
Now, this is something that has been alarming to see coming in Wisconsin. How devastating has this syndrome, white nose syndrome, been in other parts of the country?
Sure. The disease arrived in New York State in 2006 and 2007 and really, you know, began decimating individual cave and mine populations at that time and rapidly spread. It's now in 26 states and 5 Canadian provinces. And in 2012, approximately 6 million bats had been killed by the disease. Those numbers are obviously a few years old at this point, and with the rapid spread of the disease, we can assume it's been many more bats than just those initial 6 million. So what we see is a 90% overall decline in individual affected cave and mine populations.
Talking to Jennifer Riddell from the DNR. She's a conservation biologist looking at the announcement that white nose syndrome is present now in 8 counties. Previously, it had been 4. This is new information after the DNR winter surveys. Let's talk about the cascade effect, Jennifer. If we're seeing a big drop in bat populations in the state, what are the consequences of that?
Well, the important thing for folks to understand is that these cave and mine hibernation sites.
Jennifer, are you still there? We'll try to reconnect with Jennifer Riddell from the DNR as we talk about white nose syndrome in Wisconsin. Previously present in 4 counties in the state, new info just out says now it's 8 counties. What a lot of biologists had feared, the disease seems to be spreading to bat populations after doing lots of damage in the eastern part of the United States. When we get her back on the line, we'll talk some more about what the consequences of this disease and a potential die-off of bat populations would be. And Jennifer, do we have you back on the line?
I'm here.
Okay, sorry we lost you there, but you were going to tell us the consequences of losing a big part of the state's bat population.
Yeah, we know that bats are valuable and that they gather in large numbers in cave and mine hibernation sites during the winter. So if one cave or mine population is decimated, those bats would normally be spreading out across hundreds or thousands of square miles on the summer landscape where they forage for insects. And those insects include not just human health pests like mosquitoes, but also agriculture and forestry pests. And we know that the value of bats to Wisconsin agriculture is $158 million to $1.6 billion each year. That would be the cost of the pesticides needed to control the insects that bats are consuming. And so we obviously anticipate, an impact. We can't say precisely what that will be or how it could be measured, but losing bats certainly changes things.
I know we have more than one bat species in the state. Does this disease target just one of those species or all of them?
Yeah, we have 7 species of bats in Wisconsin. 3 of them are migratory species, and what we're seeing is that the migratory species are not affected by white-nose syndrome, but the hibernating species that rely on caves and mines in order to survive the winter are the ones affected. And so we have 4 of those, the big brown bat, little brown bat, the 2 most common species in North America, and also the eastern pipistrelle and the northern long-eared bat.
So are these hibernating sites, the caves and mines, the place where this infection spreads?
Yeah, the disease is caused by a fungus that's a psychrophilic or a cold-loving fungus. The bats rely on these cold, dark, humid hibernation sites in order to conserve their fat reserves. There's no insect material available for them to prey on in the winter months, and so they seek out caves and mines, and that happens to be the environment that the fungus thrives in.
Well, I guess the big question is there anything that humans can do to make a difference, to slow, reverse maybe this spread?
Sure. Right now on our end, we're working to research the disease and try to come up with management solutions. And what we want folks to do is to continue to participate in bat conservation as we're working on a solution on the science end of things. So out on the landscape and at people's homes, they can continue to provide habitat for bats by putting up bat houses and taking care of the environment, providing clean water sources. Giving us time for research to catch up, and that means not being involved in the spread of the disease. So folks that are visiting caves and mines need to be particularly aware that they could potentially move the disease farther than the bats can spread it naturally. So we have decontamination protocols in place for both biologists and cavers who visit caves frequently, and then for the general public who are occasionally taking cave and mine tours, sites where they're visiting have specific protocols in place, and they should be contacting those tour locations to see what they need to do to prevent the spread of the disease.
Is there an online resource for cavers to find out what they should do before making that visit?
Correct. So in the state of Wisconsin, we do have some specific rules particular to cavers and caves in Wisconsin. And if you visit the DNR website and just search bats, you can link to the decontamination protocol.
I know over the next few months, for at least one or two of the species, it's going to be baby bat time, and people may be getting a glimpse of bats, living in their houses, getting inside the houses. Because of the current conditions, this concern, are there recommendations or even guidelines on what people should do to deal with the bats in their houses to make sure they're not reducing the bat population further?
Absolutely. This is a time of the year when mother bats are gathering in maternity colonies from June 1st to approximately mid-August, and that's when mother bats are giving birth to the pups and nursing those pups until they're old enough to fly. And the thing to remember is that the pups can't leave the maternity site before they can fly. So even though bats may leave the house in the evening, some pups are left inside. And for folks who would like to get bats out of their attic that may have them, we have a non-exclusion period going on during this maternity time. Unless there's a human health concern where bats are routinely entering the living space and that exclusion needs to happen because of a human health risk. But of course, when bats occasionally make their way into homes and buildings, the best thing is to do is open a window and let that bat find its way out. Or of course, wear heavy gloves, have an adult either remove the bat to a safe place outside, or better yet, put a box over the bat, slide something underneath that box, and carefully transport the bat out of the building.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer Riddell, DNR conservation biologist specializing in bats, talking about the advance of white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin's bat populations. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
After 7 seasons, the hit TV show Mad Men comes to an end this weekend, and with the series finale airing on Sunday on AMC. The show follows main character and pitchman extraordinaire Don Draper as he drifts through the turbulent years of the 1960s, a time of radical change in our country's history.
Our next guest says we can actually learn a thing or two about American politics from the show, and by taking a closer look at the show's narratives from the 1960s, we can make connections to today's politics politics and culture.
Joining us now is Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University and the co-editor of the new book, Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks again for having me today.
So a lot of people like the show, Mad Men, a lot of different reasons, the drama, maybe the fashion, the booze. You say it also functions as a political text in a way. Why is that?
Well, it's, you know, it is a piece of iconic sort of imagery and narrative that fits into our understanding in lots of ways with regard to sort of the American dream in some capacity, as well as fitting into our understanding of some of the shifts that were going on in the 1960s. And those shifts and changes and to some degree perhaps even revolutions, the remnants of those are still with us today. A lot of the 1960s shaped certainly the culture debates that we have these days, as well as a lot of the shifts that were economic at the time, and the growth of consumer culture that the advertising world was a big part of, sort of projecting post-war Americana in general, the United States on the international stage. All of these things were going on and shifting and altering during the 1960s, and we have various windows into that through this television creation that was made, you know, in the current time, but is looking back and examining some of those shifts as they were going on.
Well, I want to hear Don Draper now. Here he is telling us how he'll advertise slide projectors.
And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia.
And nostalgia is the starting point of the book for you, Lily, and it's complicated. There's this nostalgia for the good old days, a simpler time of the early 60s before things went, you know, crazy in the United States. But as the show tells us, as we know from our history, things weren't so simple. Can you talk about how the show tries to untangle that nostalgia?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting points with regard to the show. Of course, you know, there's a nostalgia for the sort of white picket fence, leave it to beaver kind of Americana of the late 1950s, early 1960s, when, you know, essentially most women were wives and homemakers, although there are quite a few women in the workforce, but they weren't, you know, sort of seen in a lot of ways. And then you have also a sort of nostalgia for the activism of the 1960s, the changes that came about from the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the sexual revolution and Stonewall. And so both on the left in the United States and on the right, there's this sort of interesting nostalgia for the glory days of one part of the 1960s or another. And that sort of nostalgia is still with us because it's still shaping sort of the way we think of who we are as Americans, and you know, how the United States is as a country. And we're still in some of those battles today.
And with that reality and substance on one side and invention and style on the other, I mean, you're telling a story about what America is thinking about itself versus what it really is. And in your contribution to this collection, you talk about Don Draper representing that, who he pretends to be, who he really is, if he really is anything.
Sure. I mean, I think that the sort of Don Draper, Dick Whitman construction, again, fits really interestingly into the long history of American, quote, literary heroes. Most, you know, most predominantly, he looks and seems like Jay Gatsby from Fitzgerald's famous book. But he also, you know, fits into some of the earlier writers. Herman Melville has this great and complicated novel called The Confidence Man. And then, of course, Edgar Allan Poe has a short story called The Diddler, which are about grifters and con men. But there are also some of the versions of them, these grifters and con men, also take the form of sort of godlike creatures. And so it's a question of somebody who's also pitching and selling, which is exactly what Don Draper has done during his professional career, and what he's selling and to whom he's selling. And his great success as a man in advertising is that he kind of understands how to sell things to people at the time and in ways that will persuade them to buy products. And so he's potentially a grifter or a con man on a really substantial scale and made him a millionaire as well.
Talking to Lily Gorin about the new book she co-edited and contributed to. It's called Mad Men and Politics, about what the long-running, just-about-to-end TV show can tell us about American politics and society. Let's get into the advertising industry a little, Lily. The whole show is set around people selling advertising. What do you make of that as far as what it tells us about the future of advertising, the present of marketing and advertising in the United States?
Well, you know, that was the 1960s was really when advertising started to take off as an entire industry. And there were developments in terms of, you know, what Madison Avenue became known for as an advertising mecca. And it was also this point where there were Americans with more disposable income as a result of the post-war boom years, as well as America growing up and entering into the sort of the Cold War and developing a substantial military presence globally. And so military corporations were also looking at ways to sort of craft their messages. You had the booms that were going on in the West, particularly California, and we see that integrated into the television show as well. And so you have during this period is sort of growth of consumer culture that we live in today, and the professionalization of the way that advertising was used to sell things to all sectors of society. Most particularly in the show, of course, you see the division between advertising that was pitched to men, the businessman who's the traveler, and so they're pitching hotels and airlines and credit cards to men, and then to women, which were essentially home appliances and beauty care and so forth. And so you see the differences in the pitches that are being made by the folks at Sterling Cooper and some of the other advertising agencies to different sectors in the economy. You even have a discussion early on with regard to pitching Admiral television set to the African American community. And you can see sort of the growth of the way that advertising now, you know, is pitched to young people or senior citizens, men and women, urban dwellers versus rural dwellers and so forth. And that's all coming together during the 1960s as well.
Now, from the perspective of a viewer of today, it can be easy to look back at the how the show portrays sort of a casual, implicit racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, you know, and then there's the women drinking and smoking while pregnant, and just a feeling, hey, good thing we're past all of that. We're so much better now. Is it more complicated than that, though?
I think it is more complicated than that, and I think that's part of the you know, sort of the point that the show is making, is that we do look at that and say, yeah, hey, we don't smoke like that. We don't drink like that while we're pregnant. And, you know, our children don't put plastic bags over their heads, or at least we hope that they don't. They're all strapped in their car seats in the back seat. And so that we live these much safer lives. But the sort of points that some of the show is making with regard to the experiences of women in the workforce, the experiences of African Americans in the workforce, the experiences of Jews and gay individuals in the workforce, are different in certain sense now than they were then, but some of the difficulties that they face with regard to sexual harassment, with regard to racism in the workplace and so forth, some of those things are still with us, and the show is highlighting sort of a more egregious form of it, but some of it is, unfortunately, as people have said to me, yeah, I experienced that last week in my place of employment. The Secretary Day flower arrangement that was given to a friend of mine who's a law firm partner, just like Peggy received them, and she's not a secretary either.
So quote the creator of the show saying, this is a science fiction show, but it's set in the past instead of the future. And a lot of times science fiction takes a fictional futuristic setting, not to talk about the future, but as a window into the present day when it's created. How much does Mad Men tell us about where we are now during the run of the show in real time?
Well, I think that there are aspects of sort of the current political dynamics that are being integrated into the show, and they're explored in ways that, you know, again, it's speculative fiction. That's what science fiction is. It speculates on, you know, what might a different version of this experience be like. And so I think that particularly with regard to the role of the women as they're coming into careers, most particularly Peggy Olson and Joan Holloway, that they are sort of these examples of women who are trying to figure out how to negotiate in what was then a man's world. Our world is not as much of a, quote, man's world as it was, but it's still often difficult for women and, you know, people of color and, you know, different sexual orientation to negotiate some of these paths as they enter the workforce, and they don't know what the norms are, what's expected in terms of the way they conduct themselves based on differences from the majority population with whom they're working.
As we wrap up, Lily, are you planning on a viewing party for the last episode?
I'm planning on watching it without tweeting through the first round, and then perhaps watching it again and then tweeting after that.
Rewatching and then retweet and spoilers, let them fall where they may.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's great.
That was Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. She's co-editor of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Mad Men and Politics.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. One of the pleasures of early spring and summer is a chance to eat meals outside in the sunshine.
Eating al fresco is one way to make sure we get our daily allotment of vitamin D. So for this Food Friday, we tasked our own Lori Skelton to create a brunch menu that would be perfect to eat outside.
And we want your ideas on this, too. Do you have a signature brunch dish? And what would you add to your dream brunch menu? What do you think would make for a great outdoor brunch item as it gets warmer? And what about eggs? Do you have to have eggs to call it brunch? You can call in, share your thoughts and your recipes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton joins us now. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
G'day, mate.
Well, and that's a little clue to what gave you the idea to explore ideas for brunch outside. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration.
So much of Australian life is spent out of doors, and somebody recently gave me the latest book from the Australian food blogger Katie Quinn Davies. She was originally born in Dublin. She's now living in Sydney. She won a James Beard Award a couple of years ago for her food photography. In addition to her recipes and her writing, she does take great pictures. She's worked for Vogue. She's worked for Martha Stewart. Lady knows what she's talking about. And this book is called What Katie Ate on the Weekend. And as I was reading it, I was just so caught up. This is going to be the book that I'm going to be cooking with for the rest of the spring and summer. So much of this is about fresh produce. This is the kind of book where you can go to the farmer's market in the morning, come back, and instead of saying, well, now what do I do with all of this good stuff, you can have an amazing informal brunch, have friends come over, kick off their shoes, and stand around in the backyard by noon. It's that easy.
Well, 'tis the season. The farmers markets are kicking into high gear. Do you think that those local ingredients are key to having, you know, summer meals, especially summer meals outside?
Well, what would you say to chocolate pancakes with Door County sour cherries?
I'd say yes, my and man. Where are they?
Well, the sour cherries aren't here yet, but I have got a couple of vendors that I will be talking to come August when the cherries start making an appearance. That's one of the recipes from What Katie Ate on the Weekend that I will be looking forward to cooking to later. But yes, I do think having the opportunity of seasonal food, as Rob and I talked about last month, the idea that if you're not trying the weird things that somebody has maybe just a little of, a farmer is not going to be inspired to keep growing or keep cultivating the odder things. So it's wonderful to take a chance, but you can occasionally get stymied. I've gotten into this habit so often. I go to the farmer's market. I say I'm only going to buy a little. I come home loaded down with stuff, and then I'm not quite sure where to get started. And this is a really great way to work with it.
All right, well, let's get to our brunch outside. Nice informal occasion. You're never going to be formal eating brunch outside.
Absolutely.
Big picture, what kind of dishes, what kind of things should be on the menu?
One of the things that I liked about what I made for us to eat today is that it was certainly hearty, but it wasn't heavy. And the fewer dishes that you have to deal with, the better. I made what Katie calls a three-bean potato pie, and I used my Dutch oven to make it. And so it was essentially a one-pot meal. Once I had mashed the potatoes to put on top of the pie, everything else was in the Dutch oven before the potatoes went on it. Dutch oven went right into the oven, and literally within an hour, you can have this amazing creation that has all of these layers of flavors and yet is not going to weigh you down. I think having something substantial for brunch is needed. You don't want something that's too sweet, too light. You do need something to ground you. But if you start off with something really, really heavy first thing in the morning, I think you're in trouble.
You're going to be logy all day. Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that definition of brunch, because to some people, brunch means eggs and pancakes. But on the other hand, it's, you know, you get up late. It's maybe closer to noon than it is to 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning. So what do you think really are the components that have to come together to call it brunch?
I am somebody who does like eggs as part of my brunch. I do need the protein, and I do need something a little bit savory. While I will never mind something sweet to start the day, if that's all I have, I'm in trouble. I know by 1 o'clock I am just really, really spacey. And that was another thing that I thought this three-bean potato pie would be so great with. It's a beautiful vegetarian option. And if you decide to omit the dairy in the potato mash, you can even make this vegan and not worry about it. But it would also be a lovely thing to, when you put this in the oven, to actually make a couple of wells, some indentations in the top of the potatoes, crack a couple of eggs in, and you've got baked eggs right there.
That seems like something that's really in style now, putting eggs on top of things, isn't it?
Fried egg, yeah. So many things are good. I love doing that at home.
It's my favorite way to use up the last of my spinach. If I know that one day more the spinach will be off, I just wilt everything that I've got down with some onion and put it in the oven, crack a couple of eggs on top of it, and bake it for 5 or 10 minutes. Real easy, but it's a great way to use up the last of your spinach.
Food Friday, we were talking about brunch, ideally brunch outside with a nice weather. Lori Skelton is with us, our own foodie here at WPR. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has to be there for you to call it a brunch? What do you like to serve at brunch, or better, what do you like to eat when somebody else makes it for brunch? And do you have a secret tip for how to serve eggs, lots of them, to lots of people? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or go to the Central Time Facebook page where we have that recipe, vegetarian shepherd's pie, we're calling it now, right? Just give us a couple basics. It's in the Dutch oven. It was topped with sweet potato, right, and regular potato?
Katie recommends a very specific, so many ounces of sweet potato, so many ounces of a floury russet. I basically boiled it down to make certain you've got a total of 3 pounds of potatoes. I liked using 2 pounds of sweet with 1 pound of russet, but you can play around with it. You then wilt down standard onion, carrot, a little bit of celery, add some leek for interest, throw in some smoked paprika, a little bit of tomato paste, some wine, some vegetable broth. Let that simmer as the base of the pie. Now, Katie recommends a combination of kidney, cranberry, and adzuki beans. Now, I think you can do any three-bean combination that you think would be tasty, but let me put in a plug for adzuki beans. These are native to China. If you've ever had a red bean paste dessert in any Asian restaurant, that's the bean in this. It's a small red bean. They are very tasty on their own, and The lovely thing about adzuki beans, they're easier to digest than a lot of beans, so you're not going to have the, shall we say...
The beaniness.
That
very
one,
delicate rind.
That one windy issue.
We're very delicate here at Central
Time. Yes,
we are.
So once you've got your vegetables wilted, you add beans, you add spinach. I actually added more spinach than Katie called for. Mm. And again, this time of the year, go to the farmer's market if you've got interesting greens like young mustard greens or kale or collards. That would be a lovely thing to wilt in here as well. You top that with your mash of sweet and russet potatoes and sprinkle on a little bit of Parmesan cheese, bake it for 25 minutes, and you're good to go. What was interesting when I was asking people here on 7th floor, what would you serve this with? Most people said this is lovely and hearty, but it does need a little bit of sweet. So some people suggested fruit or a fruit salad. Some people suggested things like cinnamon raisin toast, that you need a little bit of something sweet. But the flip side of that, a lot of people were saying, I need more green with this. And this is a perfect time to bring up something that I've just discovered. This time of year, if you've got, whether it's morels or fiddlehead ferns or the first young asparagus, I have become absolutely in love with a simple walnut vinaigrette on top of spring vegetables. Blanch your vegetables briefly, just a minute or two in boiling water, then shock them in cold water, and then while they're still somewhat warm, they don't need to be cold, but while they're still somewhat warm, dress them with a simple vinaigrette of two parts walnut oil to one part light vinegar, like a champagne vinegar. We tried this with morels and fiddleheads last week and just knocked our socks off with it.
And Lori, when you say wilt, do you mean just low heat, a little olive oil in a pan?
You can do that with things like greens, your mustard greens, your kale, your whatever. For something that's a little bit firmer, like asparagus or mushrooms, there you'll want to briefly boil them. Hmm. Briefly boil them in on the stove, like I say, no more than 2 minutes, and then shock them in cold water to stop them cooking. They'll still stay green, they'll still stay crunchy, but they will have been cooked.
And just real quick, Lori, when I hear blanching, usually it's people say ice water, and that always stops me cold. I'm not going to take the time to assemble ice water. Can you just use cold water from the tap?
Depends on how cold your cold water is. Don't forget, you're going from boiling to absolutely stopping the cooking process. So I've had it work using cold water from the tap if you stand there with your colander and let the water run on it for 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
And I know how busy you are in your kitchen. I don't know if you've got time to stand around that
much. I don't either, but I like the idea of someone else blanching it.
The process of making ice water is just it's just a step too far in complexity.
Well, it is when you've got the boiling water and the ice water.
Fair enough.
I have to draw the line somewhere, people.
We're talking to Lori Skelton, one of our Food Friday regular guests, about her perfect alfresco brunch menu.
And we're taking your calls. What would you include on an outdoor brunch menu? What about an egg dish? Do you think you have to have that to call at a brunch? And how do you serve eggs for a big group of people? Do you have a signature must-have brunch item? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've got a recipe at the Central Time Facebook page, by the way. Coming up, more brunch and a little cake along the way. First, look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about her dream menu for a brunch eaten outside in the sunshine.
And you can join in. What is on your dream brunch menu? What has to be there? What makes a meal brunch? Is it eggs, cinnamon rolls, sweet stuff, bacon? What do you serve when you serve up a brunch? And have you gotten outside to eat on the porch this year so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Check out a recipe while you're there. By the way, if you're looking for more food fun and you're in the Madison area tomorrow morning, stop by the Monona Terrace for a live broadcast of What Do You Know? Wisconsin foodie host Kyle Cherik will be stopping by as Michael's special guest. It's tomorrow at 9:30. Tickets at the door or online at notmuch.com.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Owen with us from Richland Center. Owen, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you do for brunch?
Well, you know, I was listening and I heard the the bean potato dish, and I thought, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Hi, Lori, by the way. This is Owen, your potato guy from the farmer's market.
So what would you put on top of a vegetarian shepherd's pie, Mr. Rosefin Apple Fingerlings?
Well, I have to say, you know, beans for brunch, I think that's a fabulous idea, and I really want to try it next time I have the opportunity to do brunch. But I have to quibble with your selection on potatoes.
Uh-oh.
You're going for those straight russets? No. You've had those Purple Vikings, best mashed potato. Now, and especially if you want to keep the dairy out of it, they have such a fabulous texture that it won't cause you any problems to leave out the dairy.
Okay, purple russets mixed in with sweet potatoes.
Purple Vikings.
Purple Vikings.
Vikings. Okay, I'm not saying that it's not going to taste good, but purple and orange together.
There's Snow White on the inside. But,
okay.
No, there are some of the blue varieties that I'm sure would work great. I'll have to look up this recipe to give it a shot.
Maybe. Wait a minute. Are you going to be at the market tomorrow?
Oh, yeah.
Tell you what, I'll bring you the recipe.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Oh, and you've just been called out by your potato guy, Lori. So are you going to try this, Purple Vikings?
Absolutely.
And sweet potatoes.
I trust Owen. Believe me, I trust the folks at Butter Mountain. They know what they're talking about when it comes to spuds.
Begun this potato war has. We go back to our callers now. Tona is on the line in Bayfield. Tona, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention Stratas, because you can do, like, savory ones or sweet ones. We have a favorite that we do with, you know, the flavored cream cheese and maple syrup and dried cranberries. And that's really good.
Sounds really good. Remind me what a strata is. I know it's layers of something, and I'm not sure what.
Yeah, you just do any kind of bread, any kind, you know, you can use to match your flavors, and a lot of egg, and then some kind of a cream in there with the savory ones. Often people use, like, a cream canned soup with it in the egg, you know, like if it's chicken, cream of chicken or something. With the savory ones, often it's, with the sweet ones, it's often cream cheese and some other sweet, like berry or nuts. Or, you know, you just kind of layer them or break up the bread and then bake it, and they're wonderful.
Sounds great, Tona.
So many different things with them.
Thanks so much for sharing that, kind of an egg bread casserole, in effect. Is that going to be your egg delivery vehicle, Lori, that you've been hunting for your outside brunch?
Possibly. I've not tried any flavored cream cheeses whenever I've baked with cream cheese. I've always gone for straight and then used the flavors in another way. And I'm really fascinated with the idea of cranberries in a strata. That one I've never come across. So I may just have to try that later in the season.
We did blueberries this winter and used sliced croissants for the
Ooh.
Bread, and it was the best and easiest
duty.
Thing I've ever had. It was so good.
Plenty of butter.
Yeah, I'm a big
and
fan
healthy
of strata.
Too.
Well, let's not, you don't run healthy all the time in winter in Wisconsin.
You just take a little slice. Right. Speaking of little slices.
Mm-hmm.
Why
are you looking at me?
No. Am I the only one around here who's gotten completely obsessed with the Great British Bake Off?
Yes.
Crickets.
What is
Sorry,
this thing
what
you
is
speak
it?
Of?
Oh, the Great British Bake Off showed up on public television this past summer. It's actually the fifth year they've done it. This is Britain's answer to American Idol, I guess. It's a reality TV show. It's an elimination contest to find great amateur bakers in Britain. So I've become enamored of one of the judges. Her name is Mary Berry. And that's how I came upon the cake that I made, a basic Victoria sponge, a very easy cake. And I think it'd be a great idea for brunch because you don't frost it. You don't ice it the way we normally do a layer
fussy.
Cake. It's not fussy at all. It's a simple cake that has jam in the middle. So it's a light texture, not too sweet. It's fancy enough that you need a fork. You know, it's a little bit one step up above a cupcake, but still not so fussy that it's going to put you off making a homemade cake.
Yeah, Lori, so mechanically, you're just making two layers of a cake and lining it with jelly in between.
Pretty much.
That simple, right?
It's that simple. And the cake is just eggs, flour, sugar, and butter. Nothing else added.
I really like this cake. Yeah, it wasn't overwhelmingly sweet, but it was sweet. It was still a cake.
You take a ginormous slice of it. Oh, I thought that's where you're going with it, Lori.
I think we're stretching the definition of ginormous here a bit.
It was a large slice of cake. And it seemed as though something that you could serve at brunch. maybe with your greens or something healthy on the side. And you could also serve it at tea time, it seemed like, if we were observing society.
This is the quintessential thing to serve at British tea. Whatever else you do, just about everybody makes a Victoria sponge or what they call a Victoria sandwich cake.
I think that you used strawberry jam.
For this one, yes. Strawberry or raspberry are the ones that generally show up on a British tea time table.
Can you use other things?
Oh, of course you can. One variation Mary Berry does on this is an orange spice cake, where she uses the whole orange in the batter of the cake and in the frosting.
Time for one more caller before we're done here. I think Chuck is with us in Milwaukee. Chuck, hi.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Chuck?
I heard your guest talking about liking things savory for breakfast and also things that could use a lot of eggs to feed a lot of people. And we've got a dish that is a pretty big hit pretty much every time we make it. It's a Portuguese dish. It's called bacalhau à Brás, which is, I guess, codfish, maybe Brazilian. And you're going to cut up a bunch of different potatoes in different shapes, so you could scallop them or curly cut them if you got like a salad mast or something. And you're going to braise them with maybe salt cod, about 1.5 or 2 pounds of that on a stovetop. If you have one of those pans that you can also put in an oven, that works great. You can prep it the night before if you want and have it all ready. And you cook it about 25 to 35 minutes in the oven. And then you're going to put your eggs and separate your whites and kind of whip them up like you would to make an omelet, I suppose.
Chuck, that sounds great. How much time left, Lori? Fish for brunch? I think that's a hit in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How would you use briefly a fish if you wanted to add it to your brunch?
I would get some of that smoked trout at the farmer's market and put it into a quiche, but I'm definitely going to be looking into bacalhau. Chuck, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Chuck. Thanks for everybody who chimed in. Lori, thank you, as always, for joining us and making some yummy food, too. Mm-hmm.
I think we'll be coming back to this cookbook later in the year.
It's gorgeous. I'd be happy to eat more from that cookbook.
We've been talking to Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies and a regular here on Food Friday today, talking about great recipes for an outdoor brunch.
We've got some of those recipes up there right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
Last night, the world lost the legendary blues man B.B. King. He was 89 years old, still touring as of last year. King had 15 Grammys, a lot of other awards to his name, and more than that, he was really the best-known ambassador of the blues.
King's voice was amazing, but beyond that, he had a mind-blowing chops on the guitar, of course. And I read this morning in the New York Times, a lot of people talking about how at one point he ran back into a burning building to get his guitar. There had been a fire that started when a couple men had a fight. They knocked over a kerosene lamp. They were fighting over a woman named Lucille, and so thereafter, he named all his guitars Lucille.
And a whole lot of love went into B.B. King's music. WGN talked with him at the House of Blues in 2006. Here's what he said about what keeps him going.
I happen to have a job that I love. I love doing what I do. So in so many words, I'm trying to tell you that it's a job that I would do for nothing, but don't tell the promoters.
We'll go out to the news with a little B.B. King now here on Central Time.